This is GamesAtWork.biz, your weekly podcast about gaming, technology, and play. Your hosts are Michael Martin, Andy Piper, and Michael Rowe. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and are not the opinions of any organization which they have been, are, or may be affiliated with.
This is episode 459, Pendulums in the Stack. Hello, everybody, and welcome again to GamesAtWork.biz, your week. My name is Andy Piper, and I'm joined by my two friends, both of whom are... And I'll pass across, first of all, to Mr. Michael Rowe. How are you, Michael? We missed you last week.
Thank you very much. I am doing well. I had a great time near the ocean last week, talking tech and playing with AI and other things. So I had a great time and learned a lot, which is also kind of cool. It's what I like to do.
Have you been replaced by an AI?
I haven't. But over to you, Michael. How are you?
I've been replaced by an AI. No, I haven't been replaced by an AI. We're all working with it these days. I'm doing great. Coming to you from remote podcasting headquarters today in beautiful Morganton, North Carolina. And we've got this fabulous show. We're all together. Let's get some tech going on. And we're going to start with AI here together on an interesting article from Gadgets 360 talking about a music generator. Not a big generator. That would be from the group Yes. But a music generator that's powered by a chatbot and ChatGPT. What was your take on it, gentlemen?
So at one level, I thought it was kind of cool. The fact that it did 15-second songs is interesting for the free tier. And I was thinking, you know, maybe we ought to change our intro to 15 seconds instead of the 30 seconds that it is now in order to also get underneath the U.S. copyright law. I like the idea. I like the fact that they're doing it in such a way that, in theory, it should not have issues. I.e., they're putting a level of governance on it that you can't create music in the style of a named musician. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, I spent some time here actually in Morganton during the hackathon, sharing a little bit about the Barbie example that we had talked about before, where Barbie Girl was reimagined as being sung by Johnny Cash, if you guys remember that. And I thought the intriguing aspect about this is it's yet another great way of looking at generative AI in this situation in an audio fashion. The 15-second free tier is good to get people started for sure, and you can have a good phrase within 15 seconds that you could loop, you know, perhaps, and do a little bit more. So, you know, you don't need to have a 3-minute song, you know, right off the bat as you're starting to play with this. But the thing that grabbed me was, and I will drop a link in the show notes, there was a CD that was shared by Wired magazine in 2004 that I still have. It's called the Wired CD, Rip, Sample, Mash, and Share. So it had things like...
I remember that.
The Beastie Boys, mm-hmm. Now Get Busy, Fake French from Le Tigre, a whole bunch of things. There was one called Sister Savior that you might remember, Michael, mm-hmm. Andy, that we used for a little while on Dog Ear Nation because the rights to this material were designed to be ripped, sampled, mashed, and shared. So immediately when I read about Suno, this chat GPT powered capability, I thought, I wonder how quickly there might now be a SoundCloud or repository or something where things get created that could be put into Creative Commons type licensure that then allows for artists to then take it, rip it, smash it.
That's interesting. I was at an online event this week, and there was conversation about making an alternative to Bandcamp that could be federated using ActivityPub, for example, but not in terms of necessarily the rights piece, the free rights piece, though, which I think is the key part there. That is interesting. The other thing that springs to mind in this general area is I was reading this week that Universal, I believe, music group, having taken its music away from TikTok because they wouldn't pay licensing, have done a deal with Roblox. So it's going to show up in a some kind of object in Roblox world, some kind of beatbox, I think. But that's, again, not generated. That's real music. That's music being made, recorded a long time ago in many cases by humans. But interesting things happening.
I was trying to find the song. There's a famous record. And what I mean by record is literally vinyl from, I believe it was the early mid 80s. That was one of the initial albums doing a lot of sampling that you can't get anymore because they could not confirm clearance on all the rights to all the music. And I was trying to remember the name of it. There was a story on, I think it was on the Media podcast in the last year, going through that in graphic detail. And so the idea of having a generative sample set, right, is a great way of kind of giving you the flexibility to generate the samples that you need for your music, which require no clearance. I think that would just be really cool. Right. But at the same time, the whole purpose of remix culture is to take known content and remix it, which kind of defeats the whole purpose. Interesting.
Unless and until something becomes known as a result of this exercise, right? Sort of, kind of?
We'll see.
Anyway, I, like I said, I'll drop it in the show notes what I found, if I can. This might be in my personal library, which might be subject to the same kind of restrictions somehow, Michael, that you just described, because I've tried to do the share from within Apple Music and
won't let you do it unless it finds it in their library.
Yeah, so maybe that's what's going on here, and I need to hunt it down off the Wired website itself. I'll look for it later.
We're
on Apple stuff.
There's a lot of things we could talk about. Even though we're not an Apple podcast.
Let's just talk about one.
And it's kind of relevant this week. And the article that we selected to introduce the topic, in this case, comes from Six Colors, you know, one of our favorite, you know, groups of people to read about. And the reaction that they have for the lawsuit that has been filed in the United States against Apple is a really interesting way of thinking about the hardware, software, and services integration for the company.
Yeah, this is really interesting because it's not just a lawsuit, right? It is filed by the Department of Justice. So this is the government saying, Apple, we're slapping your hand. And it could be pretty hard, right? And it's very different than what happened in Europe with the DMA and the activities there with the various Apple things, because that was defining some rules.
Yeah.
This is trying to say, based off a current case law and laws in the U.S., we believe you are using monopoly powers to keep your ecosystem closed and to harm consumers. Those are the two things you have to
allegedly do
in the U.S. In the U.S., for the suit to win, you have to prove those two things, that you're a monopoly and you're using those powers to harm consumers. That's the burden of proof, not allegedly. That is the burden of proof. Now, the question is, are they harming consumers in the U.S.? And are they actually a monopoly? The other interesting thing about this is... They say the two big companies are Apple and Samsung. But the lock-in isn't the hardware. The lock-in is the operating system. So it should be Apple and Google that are the case definitions of the market share. And then the third thing that I thought was really interesting is they've defined a market called, you know, like premium smartphones. So it means because they charge a lot for their hardware and they have built an ecosystem around it, therefore, it's bad. And one of the reasons I like using Apple stuff is because as a consumer, I like the ecosystem as it is. As a developer, I know if I write applications and try to charge them, I can get more people to buy my stuff than if I did Google, where most people tend to focus on the free, right? So it's really interesting to see how this is going to play out over the next probably years, the way these cases work in the US. But I do find it very interesting to see what's going on here.
So obviously a watch this space area, Michael, as you've said, and it's not going to be something that is quickly resolved. It will wend its way through the courts. It will take quite a long time. And I'm sure there'll be some interesting twists and turns as we go. But we're not done yet with notions of security and privacy and making sure that the users have the experience that they want to have. In our titular link for this particular show, we have something from ianvisits.co.uk. That's a cool little website name that we have here about
the Ian visits companies in the UK.
Yeah.
Is that what that means?
It must be.
Very cool.
And it's good for, what is the tagline? Your guide to London's culture and transport news and events taking place across the city. So it's quite good. And apparently there is an office in London that I'm not sure if anyone can go visit it, but perhaps they can, that is leveraging pendulums to recognize security and potential security hacks in the internet. So Andy, I think this was one of the ones that you found, and I'd love to kind of get your thoughts on this.
Yeah, I just I think Michael Rowe said you'd seen something before similar to this, but I never come across this before, and I think it's quite brilliant. I don't have a lot of knowledge about the or love for the company that that this is referring to that has this particular office, but evidently they in different locations, they use different forms of physical visual noise to create randomness. So in the London office, they have these pendulums, this big, large stack of pendulums that sit on stands in a big room. And just there's a camera that just takes pictures of them periodically to get a completely random seed. And people visit the office and have a photo taken with them, which adds randomness. And in other locations, they're using lava lamps, right? So I think it's brilliant.
Yes.
Yeah, the one I had heard of was the lava lamps one. So on the Security Now podcast, God, I can't even remember how many years ago it was, they talked about this. And the key thing is for cryptography, you know, having a random seed is so critical. And the way that most systems do it is based off of things like, and this is a gross simplification, right? Gross simplification. When did you start the machine and how long has it been running?
Yeah.
Plus some bit of information as it relates to the physical hardware. But that is all contained within the one device. By actually pointing at something in the real world that can truly be random, as you say, Andy, the fact that somebody can walk in the picture and it still uses that to create the randomness is the other aspect to this that really makes the random key for the cryptographic transaction really unique. And I find this fascinating. I think it's really, really cool. So it's nice to see the actual physical devices in the world.
Mm-hmm. I have to wonder, you know, what other things would be good for this kind of objective?
Yeah.
You know, might it be like an ant colony, you know, going about their ant colony business, or perhaps, you know, a cloud patterns that could be seen from a satellite camera from space, or you know, things like
you could,
that.
You right? point the camera at the sun, right?
Yeah. Just let it fly, right?
Well, I mean, that's difficult in the UK. You just have cloud passing by all day long. But, yeah. But again, random.
It'll do some random things.
Reliably cloudy, but random amounts.
Or you might be able to use posts by people on Glassdoor, although there's a little bit less randomness going on there these days because the articles from Ars Technica and others this week were very pointed here about, in certain circumstances, the requirement to having a real name, that is something that Glassdoor has been putting in place, have sometimes shown up in spots that the employee, the person, didn't intend, right? So getting good anonymous reviews is part of the Glassdoor model, and requiring names for authentication and security has some sense to it, but not a lot when they join those two pieces of data and then show it on their website.
The part that is just infuriating on this is actually not a technology thing, but a policy thing, right? And that was, when you want to delete your account, the user couldn't, they had to deactivate it, because otherwise they would store their data, including their real name. And then going through the erasure request means it could take an additional 30 days to clear that data, during which time your public information could be out there and available to say you bad talked about your employee. Employer, excuse me. This is just insidious.
So this is frustrating, and I had an experience when I went to check what I might have said at any point on Glassdoor. I could sort of re-register, reactivate, because my account had obviously been not used for such a long time, and I was thinking, no, I don't want to reactivate. I just want you to delete all evidence that I ever existed in your system. But this was all because, for those that are new to the story, Glassdoor acquired a company called Fishbowl, which did have a real name policy. And then the sort of the process of merging the two things caused names to be associated with data. It's a really frustrating story. The Ars Technica post has more details. But talking of frustrating things, I also came across this week. I don't know whether the two of you saw this independently of me bringing it to your attention. The story about the Stack, which is a training data set.
Yes.
Of course, GitHub data is being used, has been used to train Microsoft originally. But there is another data set called the Stack, which is available for public use on via Hugging Face, which is an open source set of machine learning models. And there is an ability for you to go and check or check per GitHub username which repositories are listed or have been sucked into that. In my case, there were, I think, something like 70 or so. And some of them are really, really old and probably not very useful to anybody, apart from the fact that they showed how I was writing code 10 years ago. But it's one of those things where the... whether or not you opted into this third party using that code for these things was never really made clear. And that's surprising. Could be surprising to some people.
Yeah, it was interesting. I checked in version 2, I'm not in the Stack. In version 1, I am.
Right.
And version 1.1 and version 1.2.
Did you ask to be removed?
I will now that I know that I'm in it.
I mean,
and the thing is, it's work that I did like in 2014.
Yeah.
2015.
Yes.
For which actually was an internal project.
Ooh, really?
Oh, that's very concerning. Yeah. So there is.
Yeah. Now it's something that I did internally and showed at a conference. So there is an external repository, but it's not anything. I mean,
I'm looking down here at the list myself, and I've got stuff that dates back to 2012, which was a conference I helped out with in 2012. There's stuff dating from that era of my career. There's also a ton of stuff, ironically, that refers to my most recent major employer, which of course can no longer be used because that platform doesn't have an API anymore. So good luck to anybody trying to use that code.
So I have an interesting question I want to ask you guys. I was recently invited to join into Microsoft Build for their conference happening in May.
That's and exciting.
There's an online component as well as an in-person component. So I'm actually not planning to travel to Seattle, but the online component looked like it'd be useful. Mm-hmm. And ordinarily, you're given several ways of logging in. You can log in via GitHub. You can log in via LinkedIn. You can log in via an email or Facebook or, you know, various other elements. Typically, I have always registered via email. And I'm curious if in your experiences, when you're given those options to log in and authenticate, do you ever use any of those other ones like a GitHub or others?
Yeah, for sure. I've typically used, I used to use Twitter for a long time. But of course, what it's doing, and Twitter was always a challenging one for people to implement, actually, because until about 2014, it didn't provide the user's email address. Now, that's what the developer or the person running a conference or whatever you're registering for really wants. They want the user's email address. Mm-hmm. And they want that through some convenient method. And it may be easier for the user to just click on that use social sign-in button because they're already authenticated in their browser. And then the exchange of information, which includes the email address, happens in the background, right? Yeah. So what I typically do, quite often do now, is I use GitHub because it does have an email address associated with it. But the third party wants to be able to have an ongoing email-based conversation with you and market to you and all that sort of stuff. So I did use Twitter for a long time. I don't do that anymore because I don't have an account there, so I can't even sign in through it anymore. But I do quite often use GitHub rather than Facebook or LinkedIn or any of those other things. If it's a Microsoft thing, then I'll very often use the Microsoft sign-in as well. I was doing that yesterday because I've got a OneDrive account and things like that. So, yeah, I do. I typically don't. I try not to knowingly create new accounts that are going to require me to create a new entry in my password manager beyond it being a social sign-in. But maybe that's not a good idea.
I don't know.
Yeah.
What do you do, Michael? What's your pattern?
I as you know, I'm fairly Apple ecosystem, so I tend to use the create a dummy account on the fly with a dummy email address. And as soon as I start getting any of the marketing spams, I just kill that account, which works really well. However, as we talked about, I think we talked about on this show a while recently, there are some sites that are starting to recognize when you're using one of those accounts and not allow it.
Mm.
And so for that, I do have a couple of websites that I maintain, and I can create user IDs myself on those websites, and I've done that too.
I mean,
in order to route the spam over there,
you could argue that it's anti-competitive of Apple to require everybody to have a sign in with Apple account a button wherever they have another social sign in. But anyway, let's
not. No, I don't use that. I just use the create hide my email.
Yeah.
Which you can do with DuckDuckGo. They have a similar service. Others that do it
too. I use one of my email addresses. The providers lets me do that as well directly, and that integrates with 1Password, so I can use 1Password to generate and a false email address. An email address that does go somewhere. It goes to my email provider with a weird account name. So.
Yeah, but you can easily cut it off when
you're
done.
That's right. And you can label them. As I create them, I say, I'm creating this for this purpose.
For this one purpose.
So I say that I just told you I use social logins a lot. I do. But I also have that.
I was very just curious.
Yeah, the only social login I would use is I do use GitHub for certain things.
Yeah, I use that a lot for developer-based stuff, to be honest, because it quite often import my code and what have you to whatever platform I'm using, which is helpful.
Very cool. Thank you for sharing that, guys. I know we're just about at time, and we probably have time to hit maybe one last thing before we run out. Let's do dealer's choice, shall we? Shall we do our New World Notes NPCs, or shall we hit the LinkedIn story? What do you guys think?
No, I was going to say, let's do LinkedIn, even if we only hit it quickly.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a story this week that I shared with you both. About on TechCrunch about LinkedIn adding gaming to the platform. Now, LinkedIn started as a professional networking platform, a way to grow professional connections, log your career history, build a resume, CV, etc., mark down your achievements and your industry recognition and so on. And it has become more and more of a Facebook and other everything else competitor, more and more of a needy feed. And I just think adding gaming to that environment is, we're called Games at Work.biz. So it's not a good look for us as a show to start ranting about games at work. But I think that this is completely the wrong context for adding games. And it is absolutely chasing the attention economy, just adding things to keep people in that feed for longer. It has no meaning. It's not valuable. It's not growing your professional network to put gaming into that context. And it just infuriates me.
Yeah, that can be an incredibly infuriating experience for sure, Andy. And I my take on this was LinkedIn is supposed to be a professional network. There are ways to attempt to retain that attention economy, like we just said. The New York Times and others have gone large into social and small gaming kinds of investments like Wordle and others. And I'm sure the folks at LinkedIn have taken clear notice of those sorts of things to be able to say, hey, look, if people are on our platform and spending more time like this, then they are more likely to be further engaged in LinkedIn and do more things on that platform and take it to the next steps. So, and maybe just to round it all out, the reason I asked you the question I did just a few moments ago was because I was curious to know, since I had used LinkedIn to sign in as a Microsoft property to the Microsoft Build Conference to participate in that from a career and professional environment as well.
Right, right.
So, intriguing stuff.
All right.
All right. Well, we are right at the top of our time here. So we will say a civil adieu to everybody. Yep. And hope that you join us again next week for another edition of GamesAtWork.biz.
See ya.
You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming, technology, and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us at our website at gamesatwork.biz.